So after that, I'd just simply like to say I'd like to introduce our regional climate change coordinator, familiar face to many of you, I'm sure, Mike Peverill, who will give us, I think, a lot of food for thought, which will help stimulate some ideas on what this programme of action should contain.
Thank you, Sarah, and good afternoon. Thank you very much to everyone for turning up today. I hope it's a lively session. If it's anything like the last three or four days in Northampton, Lincoln and Derby, then I'm sure it's going to be equally challenging, and I suspect more so going to all the people around the room looking physically at Brian here and around, of course. I'm delighted and privileged and slightly nervous at the prospect of what we're doing today, but in the kind of longer term scheme of things, because this is such a big issue and there is such a lot of public interest in it, and I think expectations are rightly very high. Whether we can live up and deliver those things remains to be seen, but I think part of the solution is by people beginning to work much more closely together, as hopefully you are beginning to today. So what I'm going to try and do is just sort of set the scene a little bit about where we've got to on this journey, and about trying to outline the scale of the challenge, because it is quite a considerable range of things that we've got to try and deal with here. And just to give you a flavour of how we've ended up at what we've described as emerging priorities around the room. Okay, so this is the week of intense debate, so hopefully it's going to be equally intense, and I look forward to being challenged on all sorts of things as we go along. So this broadly is, I'm sort of liking it to a kind of bit of a jigsaw. What we're trying to do is to understand what's already going on at different kinds of geographical levels. I'm well aware that there's lots of existing commitments around the region at the local level, amongst the local authorities and other organisations. So we're not trying to replicate what you're already doing, but rather to try and reinforce that commitment and provide some extra assistance and help and to build on the success that's been outlined in one or two ways. And to try to build that partnership approach wherever we can, to bring more people in and build that sense of momentum that we're all kind of working together. We're also trying to take account of this rapidly evolving evidence base, this enormous sort of churn of new reports and things that are coming out left, right and centre, and relating those to real-world events that are happening here as well. But basically the whole focus of what we're doing is looking at opportunities to mitigate, to try and reduce greenhouse gas emissions wherever possible, and to try to see what we can do to adapt to the climate as it changes in some ways in an inevitable manner. So just to give you a sense of how big the problem is, our East Midlands carbon footprint, amongst the 4 or so million of us, is in the region of 66 million tonnes of greenhouse gases. Very large numbers, which probably are a bit meaningless to most of us, and quite a large span. And I think this is part of the challenge of communicating all this is, and I'd like to borrow a phrase of somebody earlier on this week, that we need to become more numerate as well as literate about climate change, so become more familiar with these kinds of numbers. Whenever you see greenhouse gas inventories, they tend to have these familiar chunks associated with them. So whichever level you look at, from the local right up to the national, you'll see these kind of familiar things. And that's because greenhouse gas is produced, mainly CO2, from these different chunks. So industry, commerce and the public sector, almost 40%. Transport and the domestic sector, roughly equal to about 24% each. And then smaller chunks of agriculture and land use and forestry, waste and coal mining. If you compare the East Midlands in terms of its CO2 emissions only to the other English regions, we're not doing too badly. It looks quite a positive picture. We're only kind of 4 up from the smallest region, and quite a lot smaller than the South East. But it's when you begin to put that into context, as Jerome has alluded, into the international picture, that things begin to get a bit more troubling. But before I go on to that, let's just have a look at it in a little bit more detail at these different approaches, because there are lots of different ways of looking at this. And this is part of what we need to get our heads around. It depends what you look at, what you include and what you measure as to how big the footprint turns out to be. So CO2 only is around 41 million tonnes. If you include methane, nitrogen dioxide and other gases, then it rises up to about 47. If you take into account things like the big coal-fired power stations that are on our patch, then it rises alarmingly to 66 million tonnes. But the rationale for these figures is that quite a large proportion of that can be attributed to people living in other regions. If you allocate those emissions to the end user, to the consumer. Jerome also mentioned the importance of attributing emissions to where they originated, where we're the kind of cause for that. So this approach, consumption, follows a kind of ecological footprint methodology, which relates everything back to the consumer. And that does take into account the embodied emissions of the goods and services that we buy in from places like China. But try to remember these numbers here, down the left-hand side, 41 to 66. And you begin to see that actually it's a bit alarming. The one region of England chunks out as much stuff as countries like Switzerland, Portugal, Vietnam, with over 80 million people.
Which should be before? Is this consumption, production?
This is just CO2. So it's not a sort of simple interrelation between one or the other, but just to give you a sense of the scale of this. This is just CO2 emissions only. And of course the CO2 per capita, the individual carbon footprint, varies enormously. And bear in mind that at best, us in East Midlands have got a footprint of at least 10 tonnes per person. And of course there's quite a lot of underlying factors to all this, as there are to wherever you happen to be in the world. So we are an energy-rich part of the country with all this coal underlying the surface. So you've got these big emitting power stations and cement plants and those kind of things, which perhaps are quite difficult to do something about. But helpfully, DEFRA have begun to produce CO2 emission data on an annual basis. So for the last couple of years, we're beginning to get a much better understanding of what this means, both at the regional level, so we've got regional totals here, but it brings it right down to the local, to the individual local authority area. And again, it divides it up into these chunks at the top about transport, industry and commerce and so on. And government policy is moving towards encouraging local authorities to set targets to try and reduce CO2 emissions per capita in their area, and also to reduce the emissions from their own estate, their buildings and fleet and so on. There isn't so much of an expectation, I should say, on regions. So the government's approach is mainly taking a sort of sectoral approach to trying to get things emissions down. But I think I sense that there's a lot of enthusiasm and interest in local areas and regions taking more of that burden sharing responsibility, to us being responsible for a chunk of the UK's targets. I'm going to make the link between mitigation to adaptation at this point. And these are some of the scenarios that the IPCC have come up with in recent years, which sort of set out what it might look like in the future years of this century. So those are quite considerable between a low emission scenario, the green line, and the black one. And if you relate that, so this is based around the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. And those refer back and give you the kind of expected temperature rise. There's a lot of uncertainty in all this, of course, but that does help to give you a sense of how different parts of the world are going to be affected at those different periods in the future. So even under a low emission scenario, the East Midlands is likely to get warmer and drier. So the summers particularly less rainfall, so the summer will be hotter. Under a high emission scenario, that gets quite considerably worse. What else is pertinent to our patch? Flood risk is one of the biggest things. You can see the Lincolnshire coast starts to look dramatically different under a high flood risk event. So high risk is dark blue, low risk is light blue. You've got all the Lincolnshire coast under threat, plus quite significant chunks of the River Trent Valley. And what about the towns and cities where most of us live? If we look at some of the work done by the Greater London Authority on vulnerability to climate change, here are some of the things that they've come up with, that they're beginning to work on. Flooding, of course, from the River Thames. Think of things like the underground network and how that will be with surface water inundation as we had in the summer. Water resources, millions of people together sort of demanding and using, extracting huge amounts of water. Overheating, from this great huge mass of buildings, but also the increasing use of air conditioning to cool the insides down, but to make the outside even hotter. And things like subsidence and heat, windstorm, and global climate events. The social impact that will come from big things elsewhere, people seeking to move around the world in response to those things. Maybe we're not going to be affected on such a scale, but it's quite alarming. And in some respects, I think it's a bit of a distraction to think about 2020 and 2050 and 2080, because we're already vulnerable to the climate as it is. And you know, all these real world events that happened in the last few years have really brought that home to many of us. This is the flooding in Nottingham back in 2000, but this summer's more recent floods have really brought the message home that things are going to get worse and more frequent. But, as if you've got a certain familiar face on that slide, let's not lose sight of where we've had some success. And you know, it's been talked about, the Nottingham Declaration. Okay, yes, it's just a piece of paper and lots of people signed up to it, but it's one of those things that has helped to move things forward. It's shown how a little bit of action at the regional level can make a bit of a difference. And that's what we're keen to find, is other ways in which we can add to the pressure, add to the support, just move things on little by little. And as I said about the rapidly evolving evidence base, even in the time since this document was published in October, lots of new things have come out. Climate Change Commission from the Local Government Association has said the Nottingham Declaration is very welcome, but so far hasn't produced enough tangible results on the ground. And they're saying within the next 2 years we want to see real change, real sort of much more radical action, or they will recommend a statutory duty to be imposed upon local government. The CBI has come up with a report sort of stating its case, making some new commitments about what business is going to do, and asking the government to give it a much clearer framework around longer-term targets. An environment agency has recently reported on its response to what happened in the summer. And interestingly found that although it's kind of well geared up to deal with short-term events, not in a matter of days, when that stretches into weeks, actually the challenge is considerably different. So these are the emerging priorities. We've tried to make sense of all that stuff, try to get our heads around what it all means, and just kind of try to rationalise this into a few key areas where we think it's important to take some action, to orientate our action planning around. So because this is a green paper kind of an exercise, we've not yet come up with an action plan, so why are we kind of bringing people together to check whether these are the right things or not. So by all means, feel free to disagree with these things, feel free to challenge them, come up with some alternatives. But clearly the things we think we need to do are around the built environment, making it more resilient, getting better future buildings that are more resistant to climate change in the future, trying to improve the performance of businesses and organisations, identifying market opportunities, trying to look at the natural environment and understand what we need to do there to improve its resilience and make it more pleasant for us to be. And lastly, about understanding the human role within all this and what we need to do to support people and individuals and organisations to do their bit and build capacity. And finally, there are all these kind of other things which we weren't quite sure how to deal with, like energy and transport, which I mentioned, where clearly there are big emitting sectors, but we've already got regional strategies in place for those. We think it's important to identify maybe that there are ways in which we can add some extra impetus and push to those things within this programme of action, and also on things like the sort of sustainable consumption and production agenda by seeking to build partnerships with other regions and other parts of the world where action may be more developed than it is here, or where we've got stuff to learn from overseas. That's my tough and table, and I'll hand you back to Sarah.
Thanks, Mike.